I should have Premier cryogenically freeze my microphone. Well, anyway, coming up, William A. Tiller, fellow to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, Professor Emeritus William A. Tiller of Stanford University's Department of Materials Sciences, spent 34 years in academia after 9 years as an advisory physicist with Westinghouse Research Labs. Wow. In his conventional science field, he has published over 250 scientific papers, 4 books, and several patents. In parallel, for the past 30 years, he's been pursuing avocationally, that means as a hobby, serious experimental and theoretical study of the field of psychoenergetics, which he thinks will become a very important part of tomorrow's physics. In this new area, he has published to date an additional 100 scientific papers and 3 seminal books, Science and Human Transformation, Conscious Acts of Creation, and the newest book, Some Science Adventures with Real Magic, coming right up. Just one quick interruption before William Tiller. This is Matt. Matt is the one who wrote to me that Yucca Mountain was on fire. Matt, you're in Beatty? Beatty, Nevada, Matt, is that correct? Hello, Matt. You there?
Yep, I'm here.
Okay, good. You're in Beatty, correct?
Yep.
What's happening?
Well, Thursday night, lightning storms came through.
Right.
Started the fire up at Yucca.
Okay.
And it's been burning since Thursday night, and it grew today because of the wind.
Right.
And today they set up a staging area at the old Borough Inn in Beatty for about 200 firefighters, catering, showers. Trucks are going up north of town where the access road is.
How high is a Yucca Mountain?
You know, I'm not sure.
How much is there to burn on Yucca Mountain?
Well, I think there's some pinyon pines once you get up in the higher elevations there. I've never been to Yucca Mountain. But there is a lot of, you know, growth from this from the winter when we had all the rain, just like down in Pahrump.
Sure.
And it's burning out of control right now.
All right. Well, of course, years from now, when all of that stuff is stored there, we don't want to hear about fire, earthquake, or other thanks, Matt.
I just hope that the firefighters are safe.
I hope they are, and thank you very, very much for the tip. So Yucca Mountain virtually on fire, and he's right, certainly right. That has not made the news. Now our guest, William A. Tiller. Welcome, William. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to our joint adventure.
I'm sure it will be an adventure, too. I don't understand at all what psychoenergetic science even is. So that's an obvious starting point.
Okay, well, let me give you sort of a thumbnail view of that. If you look at conventional establishment science, you write yourself a little equation. You write mass with arrows going back and forth to energy. And pretty much all of conventional science deals with that reaction, and Einstein, of course, quantified the relationship between the two a long time ago.
Stay good and close to the phone for
okay.
me.
Okay. And the conventional science deals, its reference frame for viewing nature is space-time, and relativity theory imposes the limitation that everything must go slower than the velocity of light.
That's correct.
So that's conventional. And now if you look at psychoenergetics, basically you take those two terms, mass and energy, and you add another one to the right of energy. You've got arrows going back and forth to consciousness.
Oh, and, God, here we go.
And you expand the reference frame to include higher dimensional realms, and you remove the restriction of the velocity of light.
I can see we're going to get along just fine.
Good.
So you draw more lines, but to consciousness.
Right. Of course, we don't have a good definition of consciousness.
No, we
at
don't.
Point in time.
No, we don't.
But in essence, each of those terms appears to be convertible one to the other.
We seem to be learning now more about consciousness rather quickly. There's a whole raft of experiments that are going on, and you and I, I'm sure, will talk about them. And you have done some experiments of your own, right?
Absolutely.
So I want to first hear about your experiments, and then we'll talk about others. But I really, really want to hear what you've been doing and how you even decided to try it.
Okay, well, the place where we started was that there has been an unstated assumption by conventional establishment science, really for the last two paradigms, that is quantum mechanics and classical mechanics. And what is held by most scientists is the assumption that no human qualities of consciousness, intention, emotion, mind, or spirit can significantly influence a well-designed target experiment in physical reality.
Huh.
So I decided to start there and set out to either prove it right or wrong.
In what manner?
The approach we took was the following. I started with two simple low-tech electronic devices. They're identical to each other. You couldn't distinguish one from the other.
What are they?
Basically, it has some EEPROM memory element in it and an oscillator or more than one oscillator, a few diodes and resistors and capacitors, but very, very low-tech.
What is it?
In a black box.
Does it actually do anything?
I'll come to that.
Okay.
I mean, basically, the total output power of this system is less than 1 microwatt.
Okay. Got it.
1 millionth of a watt.
Got it.
And so that's the starting thing. It's in a little black box. It's about 3 inches wide, 7 inches long, and an inch thick. So just a little black box.
It's going to kill me not to ask questions. I mean,
that's fine.
All right. What kind of energy output is it producing?
Well,
it's
electrical energy.
It's electrical energy.
That's the start of it.
AC, DC?
Well, because you have oscillators, its output is in these oscillators are in the frequency range of 1 to 10 megahertz.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
But it's such a low power level.
Got it.
Remarkably low.
Got it.
There's no intentional antenna in it.
Right.
Right? So what we do is we take one of those and we set it aside as the control device, and the other one we set on a tabletop around which four very well-qualified meditators sit.
Okay.
And they go into a deep meditative state. They mentally cleanse the terrain of the tabletop, and when things seem right, one of the members states a specific intention for the device. The intention would be for the device to influence a particular target experiment, which I'll get to. And so then the four people hold that intention in their own way for about 15 minutes. And then the statement is given, so be it, thy will be done. And then there is a subsidiary intention given to seal the primary imprint into the device so that there's no wasteful leakage of the imprint away.
All right, I've got to stop you again.
Okay.
The end sentence seems to have religious connotation. Now,
spiritual connotation. But I doubt that it's religious.
Okay, all right.
Well, let me give you my bias. My bias is that we are all spirits having a physical experience as we ride the river of life together. And our spiritual parents dressed us in these bio-body suits and put us in this playpen, which we call a universe, in order to grow in coherence, in order to develop our gifts of intentionality.
Did you say grow in coherence
grow in coherence? That's the word, coherence, right.
I'm not sure which way we're going there, buddy.
Yep. Okay, and to develop our gifts of intentionality and to become what we were intended to become, which is co-creators with our spiritual parents. That's my bias.
Got it.
Okay?
Yes.
So in essence, there are indeed spiritual overtones here.
But not necessarily specific religious ones at all, just spiritual.
Not in any way specific religious ones.
I've got it. One last thing. These meditators that you had,
mm-hmm.
Where'd you get them?
Well, my wife and I were two of them.
Ah.
We've been meditating for 35, 40 years.
Okay.
And the other two happened to be friends that we knew were well qualified.
Good enough.
Yep.
All right, so now.
And so then basically we would come out of meditation and we would pass it around and see what it felt like, to see if it felt as if it was cooked enough. And by and large, we generally went back in and did it a second time, but we've never done it more than a second time.
All right.
And so then we did an experiment in which we set these two devices, the control and the imprinted device. So we'll call them the unimprinted and the imprinted. We set them about 100 meters apart, and we turned them off electrically. And we noted, we left them that way for a number of days, we noted that in less than a week, the imprint had somehow transferred from the IIED, we call that an intention imprinted electrical device.
Yes.
To the UED, the unimprinted device.
Are you telling me that information that was in an EEPROM in one of your devices,
yes,
transferred into the EEPROM of a second device?
That's what we infer from the result.
Good God, good Lord, how can that...
Well, you'll understand as we go through and talk about the experiments. But the issue is, it indicated that there was another information channel available in the universe that we knew nothing about. And it certainly was not electromagnetic, and that'll become very clear.
Well, right away... That's what I want to know about. How can you be sure that what you have not built is a receiver and transmitter capable of some kind of direct transmission?
Well, it's turned off electrically. There's no electrical power.
Well, yes, but they were on during the intent portion of it.
It was on during the intent imprinting, exactly, and then we turned them off.
Well, now, was there an original program in the main one?
No program.
Oh, there's no program. Both EEPROMs are empty.
Yeah, both empty.
Oh, okay. I'm getting it.
There's nothing placed intentionally in the system.
Got it. Got it.
And then our concern was, how the heck are we going to do experiments with these? Well, we realized that electromagnetism was secondarily involved, so we ended up, we placed the control device in a small electrically grounded Faraday cage,
uh-huh.
And we took the imprinted device and we wrapped it in aluminum foil and we put it in an electrically grounded Faraday cage.
Huh.
And in this way, we were able to maintain the imprint in the device.
Absolutely.
For the order of 3 to 4 months.
Holy mackerel.
Which meant that we could then do experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now you're going to tell me that despite the Faraday shielding...
Oh, we could take them out. We basically would take them out and ship them. We'd wrap them. We'd send them by FedEx to a laboratory 1,500 miles away where the target experiments were set up.
Wow.
And so that's sort of how we did it. We didn't send the unimprinted device at the same time as the imprinted device because we wanted to minimize any kind of information transfer. And then when they got, it was up in Minnesota, and when they got there, they were placed immediately in separate electrically grounded Faraday cages until we were ready to run the experiment.
Holy mackerel.
So that's step one.
Yes.
Okay.
I don't even know what... There's a million questions.
Right. Well, why don't I tell you what the target experiments were and what we found.
Please.
Okay. There were four target experiments, and one target experiment means one of these devices, okay? Because you
right.
only have one imprint.
Right.
So the first one was to take highly purified water in equilibrium with air, and... The imprint intention was to increase the pH of the water by one full pH unit. Now, in terms of how big is one pH unit, that's a factor of 10 of the hydrogen ion concentration. But if you take a human body, we all have a pH level in us. If you move a half a pH point on one side, that is, you go up, let's say,
yes,
you're probably dead. If you go half a unit the other way, you're probably dead. So
that's a lot.
It's a lot. That's the point. And it's in equilibrium with air, and so that means that the pH of the water becomes largely determined by the carbon dioxide concentration of the air. That was target experiment one. Experiment two was to take the same water, and the imprint intention was to lower the pH by one full pH unit. Our measurement accuracy was 1/100th of a pH unit. So we were asking for a signal that was 100 times the noise.
That's a lot to ask for.
The third experiment was we moved into the biological realm and we took a particular liver enzyme, alkaline phosphatase.
Now, I know that I shouldn't have to stop you really and ask you this, but I can't resist. You're telling me you did this.
We did this, and it was remarkably successful. Okay?
Repeatably.
Well, we'll come to the replication experiment. We go through what we discovered with these before. I mean, replication is always replication by others in other sites is always an important part of a piece of scientific work. We replicated it many, many, many times ourselves. Okay, the first 3 years of experiments, we did all these things ourselves. And it was only then that we started the external site experiments. We found some money to do that.
But good for you. You didn't stick your neck out until you were sure it wasn't going to get chopped off.
Right. I mean, we do the science in the same way as you do conventional science. It's just a little, we'll see that it's a little more difficult than conventional science because of consciousness being involved.
Mm-hmm.
So the third one was this increasing of the thermodynamic activity of a particular liver enzyme, alkaline phosphatase. And we were successful with that to about 20%, 25%. And then the fourth target experiment was to move to a simple living system, which were fruit fly larvae. And the intention statement there was to increase the ATP ratio to the ADP in the cells of fruit fly larvae.
I don't know what that is.
ATP is the energy storage molecule that is present in all living systems, the cells of all living systems.
Okay.
And the ADP is the precursor molecule. So you have to add three of the key molecules instead of two, and then it becomes a stable group, and that's the energy storage unit.
So you were trying, using those as a marker and trying to what, increase them?
To increase the ATP to ADP, which means that the larva would have more inherent energy, and therefore it would take less time for them to develop to the adult fly stage.
And your successful percentage?
We were successful to the order of 15-20% in the ATP to ADP, and we were able to reduce the larval development time to the adult fly stage by 25%.
Oh, all of this is a gigantic wow.
Yeah, and all of these things we used in the latter two, the biological ones, we had four treatments side by side under the same temperature, the same humidity. The one treatment would be out in the air. The second one would be the same thing inside the Faraday cage. The third would be the same thing inside a Faraday cage, but the unimprinted device turned on. And the fourth would be the same in the Faraday cage when the imprinted device turned on.
Perhaps I should remind you again who you're listening to. Fellow to the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, Professor Emeritus William A. Tiller of Stanford University's Department of Materials Sciences, spent 34 years in academia after 9 years as an advisory physicist with the Westinghouse Research Labs. That's who you're listening to. The subject, obviously, is consciousness. And the professor has done some experiments that should rattle academia. I mean, seriously, rattle academia. I understand, and I hope most of you do, what he's achieved. If not, we'll back up just a little bit and try and lay it out again so that you understand the significance of what you're hearing. Professor, you made just a couple of small electronic devices with some EEPROMs, an EEPROM in each one, and some other apparatus, but nothing communicative. In other words, these devices didn't in any way talk to each other.
And nothing like modern electronics.
Right. And then you were able to imprint these devices using the intention, the will, the consciousness of a total of four people in deep concentration, yes?
Right. We've done it with two, we've done it with four, and we've done it with six.
By the way, with any change in terms of the number of minds concentrating on the percentages, anything there?
Difficult to distinguish that kind of thing. The intention is to... Okay, let me back up one step. If you talk to a healer with really good track record and you ask them what they do, they tell you that they just try to be as perfect a channel as they can to let the universal energy flow through.
Mm-hmm.
We try to do the same thing in this regard, and so it's almost as if the unseen universe does the heavy lifting.
Apparently. I don't want to break into this, but I did experiments on the air using millions of minds. Mm-hmm. I did this quite some time ago, and it did seem to have a tremendous effect on weather systems. I'm just not going to go into the whole story right now,
right.
But we did these experiments, and I realized the power of consciousness.
Yes.
It hit me like a brick, not quick enough, because I did about 10 or 11 experiments before it hit me, but it did hit me. And then I started looking at what Princeton is doing.
Yes.
And now comes you, Professor, with more really serious, hard evidence.
Right, and I should add one thing to the tail end of the statistical experiments with the biological systems. And we found that the statistical probability, the p-value, was better than 0.001, which means that there was less than one part in 1,000 chance that it occurred as a random phenomenon. So these are very robust experimental results. And if you ask yourself, well, what does this tell us? Of course, the first thing it tells us is that the unstated assumption of conventional establishment science
is wrong.
Is incredibly wrong.
Yeah, way wrong.
Way wrong indeed. And the second is that the intention applied this way, that there's a kind of intelligence in the imprinted device, because the one that's for the water pH to go up, the experiments, it only goes up, it never goes down. The one for down never goes up, it always goes down.
This is to us as magic.
Well, exactly, and you know, Arthur C. Clarke said a long time ago that any sufficiently advanced technology beyond your own must appear as magic.
And it does appear as magic.
And I paraphrase that to say that any experimental observation or personal observation that can't be explained by the conventional paradigm has to be considered as magic, as real magic, until the paradigm is expanded to see the lawfulness of the data.
I have a feeling this will be regarded as magic for some time to come, despite the great advances that we're making in our beginnings of understanding of this phenomena, this force, whatever it is. It's going to be a while, I think, before we fully understand it.
Oh, I think so. Now, and I need to add one other thing, because, at least in this primary part, it is that we came to the conclusion that the action of this device, this intention-imprinted electrical device, just by being turned on in the room, and over a three-month period, it looked as if we were conditioning the space itself, that is, we were changing it in some way that we were beginning to access another level of physical reality. And that actually was the precursor that for any psychoenergetic experiment to be successful, you have to first get to that stage where you access.
How did you determine that with the device?
Okay, now the way we determined it is a second group of experiments. We noticed that there were three characteristics of what we call a conditioned space. That is, we saw the experimental data. It didn't really change much for about the first 2 months, and then it started to rise and rise and rise and then taper off and plateau at the level of change intended by the particular experiment. And then once it was at that plateau level, that upper plateau level, you could take the device away, put it in a Faraday cage, and it would, things would stay at that level. So we decided that the space had been conditioned somehow by this little device, and there were remarkable things happening. So let me talk about the remarkable things that happened then.
Please.
The characteristics, there were three of them. There was first, we observed, and I'll explain it in what this means in a minute, a DC magnetic field polarity effect. The second one was we observed oscillations of material properties, as oscillations of pH, oscillations of electrical conductivity, oscillations of water temperature, oscillations of air temperature. When I say oscillations, I mean for air temperature, something like 3 degrees, and the thermistor we were using, we have two kinds. One is measures a hundredth of a degree sensitivity or a thousandth of a degree sensitivity. So again, we're saying that the signature of the oscillation amplitude was 100 to 1,000 times the noise.
And the
third characteristic was what we'll label an information entanglement between remote spaces, which is very much like that initial experiment of setting these things 100 meters apart that I talked about earlier.
The quantum effect, yes.
Well, we'll talk about that.
That is where it's going, though, right?
It's quantum, but it's not conventional quantum.
Right.
Because we're talking about macroscopic spaces like 1,000 cubic feet at room temperature, being information entangled with another laboratory of a similar size 6,000 miles away. And so we'll come to that. That came out of the replication experiment. So
that's quantum, though. It sounds quantum to me.
Well, that's because people talk about information entanglement, and the only one they know is the quantum one. But the quantum one is dealing with nucleons, very small particles near absolute zero. Okay, of temperature.
Do you claim, Professor, to have some understanding of how the information gets from you?
Yes, I do. We may get into that, but that may be a little more complex than your audience would like. But we can, let's just move the next step. The next step
is,
let me go back to this business of DC magnetic field polarity effect.
Right.
When you're measuring pH, you have a jar containing water, and you have a pH electrode and a temperature probe.
Right, you're measuring.
Right. And what we did was we put a disc magnet underneath the jar and centered along the axis of the jar, so it's all very symmetrical. First, let's say with the North Pole up, and we continuously monitor the pH for 4 or 5 days. And then we just turn the disc magnet over, and the South Pole is up. And we monitor for 4 or 5 days. Now, that's a heretical experiment because most scientists know, well, probably every scientist knows, that at our normal atom molecule level of reality, we only have magnetic dipoles. And if you invert the order, the orientation of a magnetic dipole, you don't change the energy at all. So the magnetic force should not change at all.
Right.
And, in fact, if you do that in an unconditioned space, you get no effect. However, we see differences of a half a pH unit in a conditioned space or 1.5 pH units in a conditioned space. Huge effects. And so if you say, well, how is that possible?
In pH, huh? The reason I'm saying this is because they make magnetic water conditioners. Are you aware of those?
Yeah, I'm aware of those. That's a different... They're using...
They're trying to remove...
Normal dipole magnet systems.
To remove particulate matter, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a standard kind of procedure.
But it shouldn't have any effect on pH, or would it?
No, it shouldn't have any effect on pH if the space and if the equipment is in our normal, it's called the electromagnetic gauge symmetry state of our normal world. With this when you condition the space with one of these little devices, mm-hmm. we access another level of reality. So doing that DC magnetic field polarity effect and seeing a big pH difference, if you ask yourself, how is that possible to get?
Another field of reality, you refer to the effect of consciousness?
That's the starting point, okay? And then it's in the device, and then the device does something to the room. And the room then, in the room and the equipment that's in the room now, is able to access something in nature that couldn't access before. And if you ask yourself how you can get that effect, you can only come to the conclusion you have to access magnetic monopoles. All right, now that's a heretical statement because the U.S. government and other governments of the world have spent billions of dollars searching for magnetic monopoles, and they haven't found them. But all that really says is that you can't access them from the normal electromagnetic gauge symmetry state of our world. It's called the U1 state. And in essence, when you lift that state to some other level, and our experimental data shows that you do, then you are able to access this other level of reality. Now, where is it? All right, that's the next experiment, these oscillations. We decided to probe these temperature oscillations that in the room, they're global in the room, mm-hmm. and we set up a Faraday cage with a jar of water and pH measurement system in it, and we had a line of thermistors about 11 feet long going from where the cage was out into the hall, and the temperature oscillations were the order of, as I say, 3 degrees centigrade. Now, for normal reality, away from what you would call a source, it should just fall off asymptotically to zero as you go away from the cage. Well, this doesn't. Turns out it goes asymptotically, it falls off, and then it builds up again to a big peak, and then it slowly falls off as you go 11 feet out into the hall.
Wow.
Now, we said, okay, well, you can get temperature oscillations just by density inversions in the air, so let's check that. So what we did is we blew a strong fan on these line of thermistors, and the oscillations, they jiggle a bit, but then they stabilize themselves, and they stayed. So it says that the oscillations are not coming from the atom molecule level of physical reality. They're coming from another level.
From another reality.
Well, the other level, from my modeling, is that it comes from the coarse physical vacuum level of reality. And what that is if you look at any atom or molecule, the nucleons that make up that atom and molecule are incredibly small. So most of it is empty space. And I call that empty space the vacuum level of reality. That is, there is stuff going on in that level of reality that we are affecting by consciousness.
Dark matter?
Well, we can come to that too, because there is a relationship.
Could that be what you're talking about when you talk about that?
Well, let me say there is a distinct connection, but it's more complicated than that. So I don't want to jump to that conclusion, but I can indicate how that can come about.
Well, still, what you've discovered is, I mean, so far, it's gigantic.
It is gigantic, and I think the thing, you know, most people think of the physical vacuum as being nothing, just because it's the absence of atoms or molecules or nucleons.
Right.
But if you look energetically, you find, and Wheeler did this calculation a long time ago, and he's a very famous astronomer and physicist, and for quantum mechanics and relativity theory to be internally self-consistent, and that is all that science can ever do for you. It can't give you truth. It can only give internal self-consistency.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that Wheeler calculated that each cubic centimeter of vacuum had to contain a potential energy of 10 to the power 94 grams per cc. It's huge.
Yes.
But what does it mean in a practical terms? So let's just look at two sums, and we'll compare them. The first one is, let's say, take a volume of our universe, 15 billion light years in radius, and we multiply it by the average matter density. And astronomers give us that number. So we have a number, all right? We'll just place that on the right side. And now let's take a single hydrogen atom. Its volume is about 1 over 1 followed by 22 zeros. So it's very small.
All right, you're going to have to try and remember not to go over our heads, and okay, I include myself in that.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I understand. It's difficult, but let me continue for a minute, and we'll just look at what this says.
Okay.
We take this single hydrogen atom. It's almost all empty space. We multiply it by this 10 to the power 94, and we place that on the left side. And now we compare the one with the other, and it turns out the one on the left side is a trillion times the one on the right side. So it says that even that small, it says the amount of energy stored in the vacuum compared to all the mass in all the planets and all the stars and all the cosmic dust as far as we can see, the vacuum stuff outweighs it by huge amounts. What is in mass, physical matter, is hardly the fragrance of a whisper.
I can't get my head around that. I understand what you've just told me, but I can't imagine that.
Well, it's huge, and the issue is the vacuum is where our future lies. I mean, that's where our science needs to go. That's where consciousness has its play.
This zero-point place.
Well, zero-point is a little different, but
It's talking about a power that conceivably would be the same source you're speaking of.
Right. Well, there are two issues on zero-point energy. The zero-point energy issue is the energy. It's due to the vibrational states of atoms at absolute zero, and that energy is huge, okay, from matter, but it is trivial compared to what is stored in the latent vacuum itself. Now, many people use zero-point energy loosely, meaning that they include the vacuum energies. And I'm just trying to be more clear and more careful so that we can distinguish them. They're both useful, but ultimately useful. But the one where our entire evolutionary future is in probing the vacuum.
Well, with regard to what you've already proven, you're going to do something fantastic with it, I'm sure. I don't know. You're going to publish, right? You're going to publish?
Well, I have published it in these books, the three psychoenergetics books, and people can read about all the details there.
Okay. Well, it should be in Science at the very least.